Blog Talk Radio.
No matter what, I ain't never giving up on my people. On the street scene, my team is legendary, cause we known to get cream by any means necessary. Running the streets and coming with heat, leaving everyone in your fleet stunning defeat. So screaming militant slogans a little bit louder, people still lack economic and political power. Every time we try to unite, shit it goes sour, cause leaders of the movement are just typical cowards. They wanna stop gang banging, what kind of shit is that? They need to start with the Republicans and Democrats. The government is full of crap, so get rid of that. Claim they for peace, what the fuck they doing in Iraq? This is the fact, so stop your drama. The game I spit will shock your mama. Same as the middle name of Barack Obama. Who's behind 911? It's not Osama. Yo, I mean this. It comes from my heart. I got the torch, carrying on the legacy of my forefathers. All your fantasies, I'm spoiling and killing them quick. I'm like Malcolm on the toilet on some militant shit. So I never pledge allegiance to this damn nation. My people being treated like we live on plantations. So I'm building this revolution in the wilderness. You claim you didn't know skills like this still exist. I'm in control of every word like a ventriloquist. You must have lost all your nerve if you ain't feeling this. Listen, man, you need to change your business plan. Invest in Africa, it's the world's richest land. Give up on Americanism, Ericanism. My people never would listen. I could never forgive them for the sins they committed against my kith and kin. Rape the women, lynch the men. I'ma get revenge against the system, cause it's played with racism. Every time I walk the streets, I face prison. The brain drain causes insane pain. Hussein came to spit enough common sense so we can make change. You called it the matrix, your lyrics don't make sense. The only reason you number one is you ain't shit. Face it, look in the mirror, you on some ape shit. I can't take it, you disrespected the ancients. The track must be mixed with haram the way I lace it. Your flow is basic, people think mine came from spaceships. Everything contained in the brain is Hussein came from the chain of a slave ship and the pain of a slave whip. All a brother really wanted some enjoyment. Can't find a job, so don't qualify for unemployment. America can shove it, want me to love it. Bail out the rich, crying to the public about cuts in the budget. Arnold Schwarzenegger, you can go to hell. Spent $8 billion to help us go to jail, but you won't prevail.
Welcome to another fine episode, another fine edition of Your World News. If that sounds different to you, it should sound different to you. That's the kind of hip-hop music, that's the kind of rap music that you will never, within this current state of affairs that we live in the United States of America and the corporate structure that controls the media, that's the kind of rap music that you'll never, ever, ever hear on the mainstream airwaves because it speaks way, way too much truth. And the person that was rapping to that track is none other than Hussein Maniac Bey. He's going to be our guest today on Your World News. This is the place where each week you can find hard-hitting analysis, commentary, addressing a wide range of events, you know, not just within the U.S., but throughout the entire globe.
Hey.
You know, and as I said, you know, we're joined by Maniac Bey. I'm almost at a loss of words because I've been trying to get this this interview for a couple of weeks, and it was pretty easy. He has a strong family base. His wife is his publicist, and you know, we were able to hook this up rather quickly. So I'm extremely excited, and I want to welcome you, Maniac, and you know, I actually want to let you introduce yourself to the audience because there's so much things that you're doing. And before I introduce you, I actually want to just say that Mr. Bey is the executive director and co-founder of an organization, a community-based organization based out of California. and it's called Building Communities and Families, otherwise known as BCF, but it's so much more than just that name. I mean, it is what we need to see within all of our communities throughout America, you know, Detroit, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Baltimore. I know there's a lot of people that are doing things, but we really need to start to link up organizations and individuals with one another. We can't continue to be disjointed, because as long as we're disjointed, it makes it so much easier for the system to continue to divide and spread us apart, or divide and conquer. And it's time to continue to build upon the words, as Maniac said. You know, he's sitting on some militant shit like Malcolm X. You know what I'm saying? So we need to build on the work of Malcolm X and the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which is the project that he was working on before his life was taken. And so, like I said, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Maniac to the show. Welcome, Brother Bay.
My brother, man, I really appreciate that. That was a very humbling introduction. Appreciate the opportunity to get on the airwaves with you. A strong brother who's committed, like myself, to radical change. And basically, I'm an open book. Just let me know what you know, where you want to take it.
All right, that's what's up. I'd actually like to start, because you know, a lot of the listeners may not know who you are, your name, and that's part of the plan. Because you know, what I found out is the majority, like most of the really truly effective community organizers and leaders in America today, who are specifically within the black community, never are going to get those interviews on MSNBC or CNN or the white supremacist Fox News or ABC. And that's by design, because if they would lace their airwaves with folks like Brother Bay, like yourself, then that's where, you know, they would give you a platform, your ideas a platform, your organization a platform, and then without a doubt, people that heard about the work that you're doing, especially people within these communities that I like to call governmentally neglected communities. Other people say slums or ghettos or what have you, but communities that have a high population of black and brown skin folks, that's why they don't have you on there. And so it must have been like 2 or 3 years ago, I saw you speak on the campus of the University of Maryland, and you were given a lecture, and you opened up with a story about your life, and you got into the fact that you were raised on the streets of Chicago, Illinois, and then at the age of 13 or 14, you moved to Southern California. I think it was specifically the Long Beach area. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But and then by way of that, you got involved in gang life. You became a Crip. And one of the most profound things that I heard you say that I continue to tell young folks that I talk to today, you know, I always tell him, I met this brother who, you know, has been through everything. And, you know, I tell him about your story, but I tell them that one of the things that changed your life was the day that you said that you walked by a college lecture hall and you overheard a lecture that was going on about Marcus Garvey. And you said that changed your life. If you can open up, you know, open up that book that is your life and kind of tell – start from there. Tell the listeners who you are, like where you're from, and some of the things that have inspired you, the good, the bad, the ugly, and you know, bring us full circle to the man that you are today, and then we can, I guess, go from there.
Okay. Basically, the stuff that you said was accurate. You know, I was born and raised on the west side of Chicago, which is, you know, a very high prevalent gang-infested city. Some of the terms I'm using are just so the listeners can understand me. I do have other terminology I do use, and I will parlay that in the conversation, because I do think terminology is important. Language is vital. So we do need to change some of the words in order to change the thinking. But I'll use the word gang for now. Similar to what you did with slums. You know, there's a different way to identify something. It changes the perception. So I grew up in a gang environment. All my relatives were heavy in the gang, dope, the whole thing, the street life, thug life, as Pac called it. And so it was very easy for me to be attracted and gravitate towards that. It was comfortable for me. So even if I wasn't a gang member, I was always affiliated with gangs all my life. So when I moved to the West Coast and start hanging out in Long Beach, you know, which is, we call it Crip City USA, because it's all Crips in Long Beach. It's the only city in L.A. County that is all one hood like that. Like, it's different sets, different Crip sets, but it's all Crips. And, you know, L.A., Compton, Watts, they got both. So we like in Long Beach, the Crip City. So I moved to Long Beach and immediately fell into the affiliated with gang members. It was very easy. L.A. is just as gang infested as Chicago was. It permeated the community, school, streets, whatever. It was all around us. It was easy for me to get involved with Crips because Crips known for saying cuz, and that was a word that I grew up saying growing up in Chicago. My generation, we didn't use the word blood. The older cats did. So when I moved to Long Beach, a couple of my partners laced me with the game. You know, when you in when you're in Long Beach, you know, we don't say blood, we say cuz, this and that. So they kind of broke that down to me, and I was like, well, that's pretty easy. I already say cuz anyway. So those are little kind of things that, you know, get you into that path. You start dressing, start speaking, you start hanging. Then, you know, if you're affiliated with cats, you're going to start doing things because they're going to be doing things. So those are the little things that, you know, you start earning your stripes and getting a little rep that, you know, you down or you with it, you know, you ain't afraid. And that's how I just started. I just started hanging with cats and start being affiliated with them. And, you know, I'm not the typical story. Like, I was so poor, I was so uneducated that, you know, I fell into a life of crime and gangbanging. There were plenty of people who have that background, but that's not the whole story, and that's not a correct analysis. It is one analysis. It is one of the symptoms, but it's not the whole thing. And I think it's important to say that because we have to stop being typical when we make this analysis of this phenomenon called gangs or thug life, because it's so powerful of a force. So many young people, you know, are affected by it. I'm 40 years old this year, and I look at the way the society is now, and I see the influence of my generation everywhere in hip-hop. Everywhere you go, the youth all over the world are sagging, you know, dressing very much similar to the way we did in L.A. It's all, you know, West Coast-style culture, the tattoos, all that came from the West Coast more so than anywhere else, even though they had it. Pac and all that being influenced by the West, and then being out there in the music and in the other rappers at the time, the West Coast kind of was most prominent in the 90s. That culture spread because of hip hop.
Yeah.
So I see the reason why I say this is you cannot downplay the power, the magnetism of gang life. You can't. Because look at it, it's everywhere. Kids that don't gangbang look like gangbangers because that's the style. So it's a powerful force, and as I started getting involved later in my life in gang intervention, I took the approach that I'm not going to try to stop it. It's too powerful of a force to stop. I felt like it would be best to channel it and redirect it. So my approach and my solution and my ideology around that is always going to be in that direction, rechanneling it. That's why when we started BCF in the early 90s, We took the name Blood Crip Foundation. We had a dispute about that. There were some people that said we shouldn't use these negative terms because the people hear those words and think negative. I said, I disagree, because we want them to see these terms and start seeing positive.
Right.
Because we're not going to stop young African-American men from identifying with those. I knew then in the 90s that this ain't going to stop. They're not going to stop gangbanging. It's not going to happen. It's always going to be an element that's going to be attracted to that. Because this is I liken this as to the de facto rites of passage that we don't have anymore because our culture has been removed.
Yes.
So athletics, school, gang life, or whatever are all forms of rites of passage, things that you go through to kind of develop you. Sometimes it's a negative thing, but it's still, that's what's replaced what culture would do for us. If we had one, or if we had an intact culture. So since we don't have that, these are the elements that are out there that are, you know, develop us. But part of it is also a trap designed to get us caught up in the prison industrial complex too. So, you know, the negative part of it, it gets us distracted. But back to the story. I started running with some Crips in Long Beach on the west side of Long Beach called 7 Day Crips. And, I knew the Insanes. They're from the east side. Everybody knows Snoop, you know, and a lot of rappers from Long Beach speak about the east side. So you got the Insanes in the 20s. You got 19th Street that used to be pretty known. They're not really there no more. But they're still, you know, a lot of their little homies and stuff are still there, but they're like not prevalent as a gang. But you still hear their name. You have the North Side gangs, like Boulevard Crips, the West Side gangs with 7 Day Crip, and then the gang that came out after us that's kind of prevalent on the West Side is called West Coast Crip. 7 Day is kind of defunct, and we're still, you know, cats out there that claim it. We got a big faction in Cleveland that's pretty big. One of the biggest gangs in Cleveland is named after us. One of our homeboys moved out there. You know, there was a time when a lot of cats left the West Coast, moved, and kind of spread the culture throughout the country. So we do have a branch in Cleveland that's actually bigger and more active than we are. We kind of got old, you know, more retired, semi-retired. But our little homies of the West Coast, Crips, they picked up the banner and they doing what they do on the West Side. But now we not into that no more. Now we pushing Long Beach now real tough. We got a council that we've established in Long Beach called the Unity Council, and or we call it the Hood Council, and it's basically the real city council. You got the city council with these officials who represent districts but really aren't connected to the community like the youngsters in the hood are. So we got reps from different neighborhoods that meet, and we mediate conflicts. We do community work. We're about to have a football game with different hoods in Long Beach. I mean, you know, we're trying to organize because that's basically what we refer to them. Instead of gangs, we just refer to them as unpoliticized street tribes. They're like tribes. It's the same thing. You know, tribalism in Africa, tribalism was in North America. And the way the Europeans came in was to get the tribes to fight against each other, and then they would conquer. So Bloods and Crips can be looked upon as just tribes. They're just not politically developed. They're not mature politically. And if you understand the history, the Bloods and Crips direct lineage to the Black Power movement, to the Black Panthers, to the US organization, even though they're warring factions, they still were part of the militant Black Power movement that sought to organize us politically, be politically aware, unite based on what we have in common, which is Malcolmism, and then, you know, take control of your community. Black Power is based on controlling the economics, the politics, and the social order. So Crips and Bloods took the takeover thing. They took the militancy. You know, the Panthers are known for the gun. You know, power grows through the barrel of a gun, et cetera, et cetera. So the Crips and the Bloods, the generation, the younger brothers of Huey and Bunchy and them, they didn't have the political development. That's what happened because the COINTEL program did its job. If you look at what COINTEL was designed to do, it was to discredit, disrupt, all those things it was designed to do to black militant organizations or individuals who had the potential to be a, quote, black messiah. Well, that's what they did. So because they moved on the leadership of the movement, then what you had left was angry, militarized, but not quite socially and constantly developed youth. Most of the Crips, when it started, were like middle school or early high school age. Raymond Washington, Tookie Williams, my big homie, the one that trained me and basically taught me the history of the Crips that go, you know, because I'm not old enough to know it, is Donifu. He's an OG, triple OG. You got Monk, Barefoot Pookie, Buddha. I can drop the name. These are the original Crips. Yeah. These were young dudes in the early teens who were bodybuilders, right? They were into weightlifting. They were athletic. You had Crips that went to the Olympics. You had Crips that won Mr. Universe. I mean, this was a dynamic group of young men that later on, I mean, the Crip that won Mr. Universe was not Tookie Williams. So imagine that. This was one of Tookie Williams' little homies that he taught how to lift weights and to get buff. And then he went on, while Tookie was rotting in the pen on death row, Michael Christensen went on in bodybuilding and became Mr. Universe. I think he was a three-time Miss Universe winner. So this was the caliber of individuals who were following Bunchy Carter, Huey Newton, Malcolm, and that, but they were just young. So they were a little misguided. There was a little misdirection going on. And before you know it, the whole game had changed to where it became more criminal, a more criminal element than it was a movement element. But it was always a movement. Crippin was a movement. It was about protection. It was about strength. That's why they were focused on lifting weights and buffing and getting strong. You know, they got famous stories about Tookie and the Crips going up to Venice Beach back in the 70s. Venice Beach was a spot where Arnold Schwarzenegger, Franco Colombo, all them bodybuilders used to lift weights. They made it famous up there. Well, when Tookie and them used to go up there, they was bigger than all of them. Tookie was supposed to be in Conan, the first Conan movie that Arnold Schwarzenegger, I think he said, what, three words the whole movie?
Yeah.
All he did was flex his muscles.
Right, yeah.
And that was his dialogue. Well, he went to Venice Beach and picked a lot of cats as his extras and stuff. Tookie was going to be one of them. You know, he went to the pen right around that time that movie was being developed and worked on. You know, he got caught up in like 80. I think his trial and everything ended. He was in jail by 81, 82. He was in jail, you know, convicted. So I'm saying this is a dynamic group of people. So growing up in society, young black men are powerless. They check you. You know, once you hit 13 and hair grow on your face and you get a little taller, your voice get a little deeper, you're the enemy. Before that, they might not treat you as much as so. You know, you got cats that play for the police athletic league and the police are nice and pick you up and take you to the game. But that's only when you're a little shorty. Soon as you hit that 13 and you're a teenager, you're the enemy. You're the target. Every night them police shoot for their gunplay, they see that black figure. That's a young black man.
Yeah.
So now the same police that used to be cool with you are pulling you over, telling you, put your hands up against the wall. So everywhere you go, look at the suspension rates. Black children, especially black men, are kicked out of school all the time for disciplinary. You know, that's how they discipline us. Kick us out, put us in jail, you know, whatever. So we don't really have any, like, outlook on how we can gain power that all men desire. So for me, back to my story, I didn't gangbang because of poverty or because I was dumb in school. I was actually a good student. Till my 12th grade year, I did fairly well, right? I liked learning. I liked being intelligent. I didn't think being dumb was cool. That I never fell for that. I started banging because I loved the power and the unity that I got. I didn't experience it nowhere else in society. And because I felt like powerless, and we couldn't, you know, it couldn't even be articulated. It just was a feeling, a sentiment inside. And when I could go somewhere and just do whatever I wanted, that was an addicting power. It's not all positive. There's negative to it. But the reason that we seek that power is because we lack it everywhere in society. So you're going to do the opposite. Okay, y'all ain't going to give us nothing. We're going to take it then. And that's what Crippin was based on, taking whatever you wanted and not running. See, we was the first robbers that didn't run.
Yeah.
Crips will walk in there and take whatever they want and walk out. And if you run up, they'll knock your ass out too and keep walking. We'd walk 200. Imagine you a 10-year-old kid and you look outside your window and you see 200 black men looking like Tookie Williams walking down the street. Wouldn't you think that that's a cool thing to be? Forget that they did negative things. The power that was just awesome. And when people want to know, why do they bang? God damn it, you show me something else powerful like that, and kids don't want to do that. Why do you think kids want to go see Spider-Man, then jump on the walls when the movie's over? Or when Superman right. get done, they go put on the dun-dun-dun draws and put on the sheet, and then now they Superman.
Yeah, right.
Little boys, girls too, but especially boys, love heroes. They want to be strong. They want to be powerful. They want to stop people from doing wrong. Most of the time, they want to be that way for good when they're little. But they want power. It's innate in a young man. So when you see something powerful, you're gonna gravitate towards it. You see, most people like winners. They don't even care how they won. They just want to be on the team that wins. And when Raymond and them hit the scene, 9 times out of 10, they won. And it was really that simple. For the first couple years, they whooped everybody. And the people don't like it, but that's what it was. Period. Before the Crips came, when the Black Panther Party and the US organization pretty much had the sway over the community, you had SNCC out here. I mean, you had some other groups that was tight. I'm not going to diss everybody, but those are two most prevalent ones in terms of the history. But we're not going to only give them credit. There's many other raw organizations that was doing great work in the 60s. But they know that during that time, from 65 to 69, there was a four-year period where crime was down, gang violence was down. So the point is, when you had consciousness prevalent in the community, you had the young men joining the Black Panthers, joining the US organization, joining the Nation of Islam. You know, they had other organizations to get a part of and use their energy and their direction for. When the COINTEL program shut that down, it was by design. They wanted to prevent the rise of a Black Messiah. So how do you do that? You get rid of the Black Messiahs that exist. I mean, you got to look at the fact that these people were 20-something years old. Most of these people, Huey, Bunchy, and Fred Hampton. I mean, these were all young men that were dynamic, powerful, fearless leaders. And they assassinated them. They decimated our leadership structure and wonder why our community's been astray for 40 years. You systematically destroyed the leadership. And you left people that were not as dynamic or as powerful in place. Many of them were Toms. Let's be real. Let's be real. A lot of people breathed easier when Bunchy Carter was assassinated. No matter what they say today. You know why? Because Bunchy made everybody stick their stomach in and stick their chest out and lift their head up like men. So when they took him out, even though people cried, some cats was like, man, I'm glad they got rid of that dude because he made me be a man. Now I can go back to being a coward, a poop butt, a bootlicker. Because that's what Huey and Malcolm and Fred and all them other cats, east or west. I ain't no hater, no east coast, west coast, because they come out with it with the Biggie Pop thing and they try to say it's the same thing in the 60s. That's all manufactured. But I'm saying, that generation had a high caliber. They came out of the oppression of the Jim Crow era. They grew up watching their mamas and daddies getting lynched and sprayed with hoses and dogs sicked on them. They was 10, 11, 12, 13 when they saw that stuff. How do I know? I've talked to them. These are my mentors. These are my godfathers or uncles or whatever. And they said they couldn't do it. They couldn't sit there. And this is another dynamic factor. They were able to see, because the news was different back then, they were able to see several revolutions take place. Several non-white nations were gaining independence in the late 50s and early 60s, and it was on TV.
Exactly.
So these young people saw certain ways of getting your freedom, and they saw their parents and grandparents getting abused. They put 1 + 1 together, and they came up with 2.
Right.
And you had Malcolm doing his nationwide circuit in the 60s. Lacing all the young folks up. Malcolm had sway with the young folks. Martin had sway with the old folks. So all them young cats that was going to them meetings and going to them speeches, they became Huey Newton, the founder of the Black Panther Party. They became these people, H-Rap Brown, Stokely Carmichael. They were all students of Malcolm, whether they were in his organization or not. Malcolm was teaching them and raising their consciousness, telling them the difference between nonviolence and violence or self-defense. He put it in their head. He kept drilling them with it. It's common sense. It's common sense. Democracy is disguised hypocrisy. They tell you you can't fight for your 4 children to get bombed, but they can see you to Vietnam and murder people that ain't even your enemy. Malcolm drilled this in them, and they figured it out. Hey, we could do this because we're human beings. Malcolm taught him to be human, and that's the right that you can stand on. You don't need no piece of paper. Just got the human right to do it. So that's what we got to shift the struggle back to that. Today, back to human rights. Get out of this civil rights forum, or not even get out of it, but don't put all of our eggs in that basket. Now, how did I get to where I am today? I got to where I am today because it started with the autobiography of Malcolm X. My transformation started with that book. But I'd even say the seed was planted before that book. The seed was planted in the golden era of hip-hop from 86 to about 90 when I was a emerging young man. The type of music that was out at that time was about the Panthers, was about freedom, was about justice, was about fight the power, all that, knowledge of self. Those were all the, and those kind of concepts were, you know, were in my mind. I didn't even understand everything, but I was influenced by it. So then when I read Malcolm's book, I identified with Malcolm because Malcolm was a thug. Malcolm was an ex-con. Malcolm was a pimp, a hustler, a gangster, and transformed himself with the teachings of Elijah Muhammad and with his own research in the pen and his own studies. He changed himself. But one thing that made Malcolm stick out to me was he was true to himself. Like, he wasn't going to let nothing stop him. When he read something and learned it, that's what it was. A lot of times we ignore stuff. When we hear it, we don't want to hear it because that'll make us change. That's called ignorance because we're ignoring it. That's the problem with our people. We like ignorance. We don't want to learn. Malcolm was not that way. He had a thirst for knowledge. And when he learned something was true, he stood on it. So Malcolm started me. But I didn't quit gangbanging. I just started opening my mind up. It's a process. So I went to college. I might have been in college when I read his book. I think I was a freshman in college. So that got me thinking about black consciousness, just that whole realm of world that I never even knew about. My second book I read was Seize the Time by Bobby Seale. So I was pretty much gone by then. I was out of there. For me, as an ex-gang member, I mean, I still was a gang member. I just went to the hood. I remember, I could think it and see it in my mind, going to the hood every day with black on. I just started wearing all black, black gloves, everything. So I start tagging on the walls instead of BK, which stood for Blood Killer. I start, and my homeboy, he was doing the same thing as me. One of my boys, his name is JC. He started reading with me and one of my other partners named Hashim. All of us were all kind of reading and kind of dibbling into it together. So I would go back to the hood and tag up on the walls PK, which stood for Police Killer. Right, and we got that started in like 87, 88. You start seeing that bust up around Long Beach in certain little areas. You know, people started putting PK up and putting Police Killer because sometimes PK could stand for Piru Killer, which is a gang thing. But this, when we put it up, we made sure and put police so people know we wasn't talking about no blood, no bloods or Pirus. We talking about the pigs. So that kind of, we started getting that consciousness toward, you know, of who we were and who the enemy was. But my paradigm shift, the day I knew that I would never be anything but a revolutionary, was when I was going to college and I walked past the BSU meeting. I knew I was told to go to it, and I was trying to go to it, and I looked. And it was a movie showing. So I went in, sat down, and just watched the rest of it. It was a documentary or a film about Marcus Garvey. And I had my glasses on, you know, the dark shades and everything. Even though it was in the dark, I still kept them on. And I was just sitting in that movie in the room. It was a lecture hall. So, you know, you had like hundreds of seats in there and stuff. I was in the back. And I was in tears, bro, talking about literal, like, because I watched this show and I was just amazed that I never heard of this dude. I was 19 years old in college, my second semester in college. And I had never heard of him. I mean, all my years in school, and like I said earlier, I was a decent student till 12th grade. I was decent. I definitely scored well on ACTs and all that type of stuff. So I was like, there was no question. Like, I was very clear that there definitely was a conspiracy to keep our people ignorant of Marcus Garvey. And I knew that there was miseducation was real. Like, it wasn't no concept. They did not want me to know about this brother. They did not want our people to know about him or about his movement. And so that day, I was committed to being a force for positive change. And I've never changed from that day, 21 years ago. I've never buckled. I was committed. And I feel that Malcolm influenced me that way. Malcolm was that way. When he changed, he changed. And I think more of us need to do that. More of us need to just respond to the information and the knowledge we get. You know what I mean? And that's how we can make a movement, and that's how we can make change. We're too apathetic right now. We're like, we have such a defeatist attitude. You know, we got a lot of little energy, and when Obama was running. But see, that's, to me, I was trying to, and I wasn't trying to hate on the brother, but I was trying to pull people's coat. I said, look, Malcolm laid it down. This is people that are radicals, you know, revolutionary types, were pumping Obama up. And I'm like, bro, Malcolm said the Democrats and the Republicans are the same.
Exactly.
So unless you're better than Malcolm and your analysis is better than his, you can't change that. That's the analysis.
Yeah.
So, you know, I spoke at a couple of different little radical programs, and I saw some ruffling of feathers when I was speaking out about him. And I wasn't downing the brother. I was just looking at it analytically, which is what you're supposed to do. Don't get caught up on the personality or emotionalism. Let's analyze this. And I felt that Obama did nothing to reach for the black community. I mean, he went out of his way during his campaign to tell the Israelis that, you know, America's a friend of Israel and all, you know, whatever the typical drag is that a politician has to say. He never felt like he needed, and Israel is a foreign country. They're not even citizens of America. They don't even vote, but he had more respect to speak to them than to speak to black people in America who need him to protect us. So I felt that was weird. I was like, I didn't expect him to be Malcolm X, but I definitely didn't think it was wrong for him to kind of give us the platform he was going to use to help uplift us out of the conditions we're in. That's what we're supposed to do to a politician. Doesn't matter what his color is or any of that. We're supposed to have demands, and that if he wants our vote, he's supposed to deliver. That's what Malcolm was trying to teach us in his speech about the ballot or the bullet. His speech was clear. You either use the ballot or the bullet. Now, if you use the bullet, revolutionary politics, then he broke down what revolution was. He said the only nonviolent revolution, the only revolution where your goal is to sit next to your enemies and at the toilet and love your enemies, is the Negro Revolution. So he defined what a real revolution was and what a Negro Revolution was. And then he moved that to the side and said, but let us go to the ballot. If you don't want to go that route, then we can take over without a bullet being shot if we use the politics of, and you know, registering as independent, becoming a voting bloc, because he broke it down. The European Americans, or what they call white folks, basically are split down the middle, give or take a few percentage points. Still exists still today. They're 49-50% one, 49-50% given, you know, one week the wind blows this way, the next week it blows that way. But they're generally in the middle. So a significant bloc can tip the scales. But since we allow ourselves to be co-opted by these political parties, our vote is dissolved.
Exactly.
So what I've done is I've taken Malcolm's ideology and I'm trying to translate it into the millennium. So what I do is, for instance, I have a question I ask people. What is the purpose? What is the basis of a democracy? And everyone answers, majority rule. So then I say, what does that mean for the minority? Because we are not looking at the equation correctly when we're pumping up democracy. Hey, democracy's great. Well, we're a minority in this country. Now, if we talk about uniting with the other non-whites, then we're not. But that's another step that we can't assume yet. So just as an ethnic minority, the number two or number three, I think we're behind Mexican Americans now, but we're right there. You know, we're both close. We're a large minority. The only way we're going to have any power in a democracy is to be a bloc. A minority is ruled, and that's what they don't add. They say democracy means majority rules, but they don't understand what it means for you as a minority. You automatically are acknowledging that you're going to be ruled. So why would we be pushing democracy if we're a minority? I don't get that. I don't get why we're pushing democracy as the way, as the system, when we're the minority that's being ruled. We're being tricked to speak somebody else's language. It's like I'm getting you to speak for what I want. I want me a blueberry pie, you want an apple pie, but I get you to say, man, I want some blueberry pie. You ain't even going to eat none because you don't even like it.
Yeah.
That's how we look when we spit in democracy and going for all this okey-doke. We ain't even benefiting from this democracy. Malcolm said, democracy is nothing but a disguised hypocrisy. And that's what I named the little song you played at the beginning. I just recorded it about 2 weeks ago. It's not even finished. But I named it Disguised Hypocrisy. Because that's what I think. That's what I think is this country is. I think a lot of our people are hypocrites. So when I say disguised hypocrisy, I'm talking about our people, the government. I'm talking about a lot of. I'm approaching a lot of people in there. If you listen, fake gang members, fake rappers, they're all hypocrites to me. So some criticism has to go towards us. We do need to point the finger at ourselves. We can't blame the Europeans for everything. We got to take ownership of some of this crap that's going on in the community. And if nobody else is going to come in and change it, we're going to have to. So what we're doing right now with BCF is we're, you know, setting up councils in the community. We're in the Bay Area doing the same thing right now. They don't have the same kind of element of Bloods and Crips, but they do have gangs or neighborhoods that box with each other. So we're trying to establish the same kind of setup. It's like a blueprint, and we want to basically be able to bring this blueprint like to the same cities you named earlier, B-More, D.C., Chicago. The formula can work. So we can talk, you know, we can go on that later. I want to give you the floor if you had any other questions. I've tried to go the long route but kind of give my background and how I got to where I am. I mean, let me finish one thing. The Garvey thing got me started, but really when I met Little Bunchy, he was a baby panther, and he also was a Crip who ran with Tookie and him. He was my mentor, and he had a very profound impact on me because he took what I wanted to be and he took what I thought I wanted to become in terms of a freedom fighter, and he helped make me that. It's very important that people understand that. You can't be a revolutionary reading books. The books aren't to inspire you, but you're going to need to be taught. Like, you can read a book about football, but you got to get a coach to teach you how to play it. And so we need to link up with the generation before us and learn skills. And like, the young generation nowadays are not as articulate. I mean, you listen to some of the speeches of Fred Hampton when he was 19, 20. It's like, this dude was 20 years old.
Yeah.
And he was able to analyze the system and break it down, but he was effective at talking to people in the hood and speaking their language. I mean, he could talk to a scholar. He could talk to a cat in the hood that ain't got but a fourth grade degree. I mean, fourth grade education and still communicate. We need to get more articulate, and I think we need to learn by listening to our elders more. I mean, we need to act, and we can't wait for the elders no more. It's our generation, but we need to learn the wisdom. That's what elders represent, wisdom. They've been around longer. They can give us some wisdom on some of our planning because they've seen the same thing already, so they know what the enemy's doing a little better than us. So I definitely think we need to link up with our elders and get that wisdom and get that articulation and learn how to break down this system. Because we're not that good at it no more.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that. I mean, and don't for a second think that was too long-winded, because that's exactly, you know, what we try to establish with the show, is that we get somebody on, and there's a reason why we bring them on the show, is because they have a certain amount of expertise and life experience. And the one thing that, if you know, if they ever did bring you on, you know, one of those mainstream shows, they would bring you on for maybe 5 or 10 minutes. And, you know, as soon as you start to get into, like, the deeper context in terms of what you're doing, especially when you give the historical overview of the history of the Bloods, the Crips, and how they, you know, how they were so much influenced by Malcolm and the Black Panthers, and how they from their beginning, they actually, you know, served as protectors of the community. As soon as you get into that kind of stuff, that's exactly the stuff that the mainstream media doesn't want to hear. They want the image of young Black males involved in gangs to be as negative as possible. They want to thugize, you know, continue to thugize the image of Black males as well as gangs. And I like the point that you brought up that, you know, there's a lot of untapped, and I guess now with the work you're doing and other people are doing, is, you know, they're tapping into the talents that are there within those gangs, those structures. They're well organized. I remember talking about, they're more organized.
The gangs are more organized than the Black community is, and people hate when I say that. But the Black community in most areas is not organized. They just live there. But you got gang members that are in touch with each other every day, hang out every day, more in tune with their struggles or whatever on a more consistent basis. They have, like, whistles or signals that community. I mean, they're more organized than the people that look down on them as, like, inferior.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody came in the community and wanted to destroy the community, the only ones that's going to really stand up is going to be those gang members. Once they get politicized, who do you think were the main people in the party? Who do you think were the main people in the movement, in the Black Power movement? Young people in the urban streets, man, period, point blank.
Right.
And they were the ones in the Watts Rebellion. That was the Slaussons and the other gladiators and the Brims and the businessmen and all them gangs that were out before Crips and Bloods. Those were those dudes that stepped to the pigs and Watts in 65 and got down with them. And they never tell you the whole story. They never tell you the true story. Because if they did, they would be admitting that they got at them pigs. I mean, way more than they'll ever tell you. Way more than they ever tell you. You know, because they don't want to promote us.
Nah, not at all. And what's interesting, you said in terms of telling the story, I know that you've been in a couple documentaries. You were in Masters of the Party, which was premiered on HBO a couple years back. And now you're prominently featured in this new documentary called Made in America that was an independent documentary, but it was featured at the Sundance Film Festival, and it won a major award there. Can you talk about what that film is about and where folks can actually get a hold of that film?
I don't know if they can get a hold of it yet. I don't know if it's for sale yet. It probably will be because it's shown at the movies. This is Made in America. It's called the name has changed, but Made in America has always kind of been a part of the name. But now the official name is Bloods and Crips, Made in America. And it's been showing, you know, different places all over the country. I get emails from people that saw it and are impacted by it.
Yeah.
Basically, hold on one second.
Hey.
One thing you don't know is he's a family man. So, you know, even though we got this interview, you know, he's taking care of his family, and that's one of the other things that you're not going to see often on the mainstream airwaves is a committed Black man who, you know, who's doing his thing in terms of building up and empowering the community. At the same time, you know, taking care of his family responsibilities, being that patriarchal figure within his household. And that's one of the things I've always admired about Hussein is that, you know, he has a really strong family structure, and it exudes, you know, he exudes that everywhere he goes. And
can you hear me?
Yeah. I was just telling the listeners that when you said hold on, I was saying that this is another powerful attribute that you have, another one of your assets is that, you know, despite doing all these different things, being a recording artist, a committed individual in the community, you're also a strong patriarchal figure within your family, that you have a strong family and some young men and young women that you're raising, you know, that are your kids, and you have a strong partner in your wife, Imani.
Man, I couldn't do it without her, bruh. She, you know, the woman's role is so much more significant than I ever thought, but I think that it's time for the men to step up, though, too. But I want to get back to the movie real quick.
Made in America.
The movie came about, right. Baron Davis was a basketball player from South Central, grew up in a blood neighborhood, made it to the league, you know, got his money, and but still wanted to give back and at least try to tell our story. So he hired a production company, and they started working on the film, and I got involved towards the later part of it. I got involved because a revolutionary, one of my mentors is named Kumasi. He's a A-plus level, A-grade revolutionary freedom fighter. He ran with George. You know, he's a penitentiary leader with the prison movement, you know, to get our rights and, you know, justice and fairness even in the pen, because it's a lot about the penitentiary in California that a lot of people don't know. George's books, you know, Blood My Eye and Soledad Brother, you know, good materials to kind of get a...
Yeah.
Yeah, George Jackson. Kumasi was one of his main comrades that when George was murdered, Kumasi took his legacy and kept it going and ended up organizing the largest prison strike in California history, still to this day. So he's a very dynamic, powerful leader. He connected me to the people making the movie, and they heard me speak, and they liked me, and they saw I was from Long Beach. They had nobody from Long Beach representing at the movie, and they kept hearing about Long Beach when they were doing the movie. So they said, man, Long Beach is a significant part of this phenomenon, but we don't have anybody from Long Beach. So they called me up, and then I did the movie. It was a good movie, and I think it's dynamic, but trust me, the interview material that they don't show is way more powerful. They edited the hell out of that movie, but it still came out pretty good, and people are still obviously impacted by it, so it's opening up doors, and it's allowing me to get more airtime and go to, you know, people want us to fly to Africa because they got Crips out there. I mean, you know, this thing is turning into a real phenomenon, but it could have been far more powerful. But European Americans were behind the filming of it. So
yeah.
I know that when they heard the material, because there was a lot of dynamic brothers.
Right.
There was a lot of dynamic brothers that was involved that I know really spit some heavy stuff. And when we spoke, because I didn't see their interviews. I only saw the movie. I only was at my interview. So I didn't see everybody else's. But I knew a lot of the brothers. When I met up with them, I'm like, oh, you was in it. When they first showed the filming. And we all said, man, they took a lot of good stuff out. So everybody felt the same way. So, again, no knocking on the people that produced it. No knocking on B. Davis, because he financed it. And also QD3, Quincy Jones' son, had something to do with it. So you got to give him his props. You know, a lot of times people that got money, they're in the well-to-do lifestyle, get criticized. But there are some of them who try to keep it real and make some kind of contribution and give back in the way that they can. So I give them props for that. But this is what I told all the brothers that was involved in the movie. Who can tell our story better than us?
Yeah.
We got to stop giving our story to everybody else and letting them market it. Like, we don't even get a copy of it. We haven't gotten a copy from the producers. Can you believe that?
Incredible. Nice.
Yeah. They've had premieres we ain't even know about. So, but I'm not mad at them. This is the game. We got to learn how to play the game the right way. We always let everybody tell our story. They make, look what happened with hip-hop. We invented it. We built it. Who's making the real money off of it?
Yeah.
I mean, you got a couple Jay-Z's here and there, but that's the way they do it. They making all the money. They got all these commercials with jingles. I mean, the whole culture's been co-opted, and they using it to make money. They even still are slang. They just, Denny's got a commercial out, come out. It's on. They just stealing everything and don't give us no credit or no money or nothing for it. We got to stop doing it. We got to stop blowing up these corporations' products and our rap songs and stuff, giving them free advertisement. Still doing it to this day, pumping up these drinks and these different clothings that they wear that aren't owned by our people, that are owned by people who exploit us. So it's still more of a mentality where we don't have, you know, we're not, our self-concept ain't there.
And I just found out that the website for the movie, there's two websites. It's Made in America, the movie.com, or you can go to Bloods or Crips and Bloods movie.com. So that's Crips and Bloods movie.com or Made in America movie.com. Maniac, I want to get into the work that you're doing with BCF, because I know that one of the things that's near and dear to my heart is programs that work with ex-cons, ex-felons, and getting them re-entered into the community as integral components of the community, where they're helping build up the community, and which is gonna, you know, which lends itself into the decrease in recidivism, because as you said, the way the system is structured in terms of the prison industrial complex, when you have major prison corporations that are on Wall Street, it behooves a lot of white folks to have as many able-bodied black and Latino men, you know what I'm saying, just men in general, but we know that we represent, the largest prison population in America in these prisons, so that they're making everything from cutting meat to Microsoft products to Victoria's Secrets. And, you know, when we can establish programs to provide jobs and responsibilities and just making sure that we weave these strong brothers back into the community as integral components, then it's going to lower the rate of recidivism, and it's also going to continue to establish strong leadership strains. And I know that BCF, beyond doing all the great things that you do with youth, and I want you to talk about the work that you do with youth, but also the work that you've done with ex-felons and ex-cons, and how that work's going. And also, what is the website where people can actually check out the work that you're doing? Because I'm sure people are listening, and also people that are going to listen to this show on archive are going to want to know how they can get in contact with you, how they can build with you and your organization, and maybe they might even want to bring you into their organization as a speaker, as we did a couple of years ago.
Okay. Hold 1 second. It's a little noisy behind me. Give me 1 second, then I'll go ahead and start.
Okay. I'll just talk in the meantime. And while I was doing that, if this appeals to you, which it should, please make sure that you send.
All right. So here we go. One of the things that, in the song you played earlier, the way I ended it was Arnold Schwarzenegger, "You Can Go to Hell." You spent $8 billion for us to go to jail, but you won't prevail. That's a direct attack against this system that's putting billions of dollars into putting us in prison versus rehabilitating us or developing us or educating us. And that goes right into what you're talking about, the prison industrial complex. So if you got people that are investing in these businesses, then it's to their benefit that their investment pays off.
Right.
So they're investing in prisons to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And what is success is more people in them, not rehabilitation. They're not investing in rehabilitation. They're investing in putting people in prison.
Yeah.
And what happens in prison? Now we got to talk about that. And what is prison legally?
Slavery.
You and I will know that prison is considered to be voluntary servitude, and that the 13th Amendment abolished involuntary servitude, which is what they use to describe slavery. So what's called chattel slavery. So every person that's a prisoner is considered a slave legally. So now we got to tie this whole thing in to the history of prison and how, soon as slavery was ended, the prison piece really jumped off. If you know the history of prison, they even had a European-American historian just drop a real dynamic, and I'm going to find out the name of it because you might be able to get him on your show. But he just dropped a real powerful documentary about the whole prison thing and how it's connected to African-Americans and the end of slavery and how they set up the chain gangs. And it's a cold piece. So it was just a replacement of slavery. And so what else happens in prison? People work for damn near nothing.
Yeah.
So you have a social order that we, you know, self-hate, you know, quote, black-on-black crime and all those kind of things, which is, you know, I don't like those concepts. But the point is we have a culture that we kind of ride on ourselves. Then we got the economic situation. Then they replace the lack of employment in the jobs, because that's what happened in L.A. That's what happened in Oakland. Both of these cities that my organization is in, you know, went through the same thing. A large influx of African Americans came here for jobs. Those industries fell, and then you had a dynamic shift. You had a dynamic shift in crime and everything else. I mean, it all is correlated. So the same thing they did in the 70s, they took the jobs and they put in heroin and those kind of drugs. Well, in the 80s, they did the same thing. All kinds of industries shut down. Like in Long Beach, the aerospace industry was shut down. Huh? Leave that there. Leave that there. Yeah. Yeah. So it's the same cycle. They replaced those jobs with crack. So then they set up the unfair sentencing with the crack and the powder. You feel me? So it's all a systematic approach to destroy our people. It is genocide. And it's genocide, period, point blank. Because you look at the totality of it, it's all towards destruction. It's not a life. It's almost impossible for us to have survived this long. It's amazing that we've made it this far in spite of what we've been through. But you look at the way the prison system is set up, now you're also having longer sentences. So it's like a trap. I tell these young brothers all the time, it's a trap. It's like when fishermen go out with that net and they drop that net. They know they're not going to catch every fish. They know they're going to catch some. Then they put the net back down there again. The ones that got out the first sweep, we're going to catch them on the second sweep.
Yeah.
And the third sweep will catch the ones that got away from the first two. You know what I mean? That's the inevitability of it. Then they know once they get you in the system, then they know the recidivism rate. They know that the odds are they're going to get you again, 80 to 90%. Well, they set it all up. The young brother that just smoked those police out here, Lavelle Mixon, right? You look at his story. Like, first of all, the day after he smoked those police and he was murdered, right, the next day the newspaper came out and said he was involved in a rape a month earlier. That's odd that it was that the next day that they had DNA evidence. Why do you think they did that? They want to dehumanize him and make him into an animal to, you know, so they can never let no one identify with his act. But what is his story? His story is a typical story of a youth in the Bay Area. Very typical. On parole, going through all the different turmoil and stuff you go through on parole, trying to get out, not having any viable option. They close every door. But then again, like I said, they have these drugs. They have these other things out here as traps.
Right.
So, when they pulled him over, it was no different than in slavery. Right?
Right.
He was a runaway slave. Let's be real. And there wasn't going back to the plantation. He was like, you're going to have to kill me before I go back there. No matter what you look at. Because if you look at prison and you know legally they're slaves, then it's the same analogy. It's not even, I'm not making it up. It is that. He was a slave who was on the run. He was on parole, and they were looking for him, and he knew they were, and he wasn't going back.
Yeah.
But they never talk about why they pulled that brother over. They never addressed why he was pulled over. Was it a racial profiling case like happens all the time in America?
Yeah.
How do, what is it that caused him to pull him over?
Yeah.
See, because that's always where it starts. But they never want to talk about that. Like going into Iraq, talking about weapons of mass destruction. They don't find any. They're supposed to leave, even though they shouldn't have been able to go there in the first place. In America, you got more rights than Iraqis do, and they're not even American. If they come in your house with a warrant and can't find what they say you got, they got to go. But they can stay there 5 years, murder over 1 million people, however many. They don't never put those numbers in there. They never put the Iraqi children that are blown up to bits or eyes poked out and arms and limbs missing, just like this whole Iranian thing. I mean, Iran got 50 million people, bro. It's a big country. Like, they had these protests that they kept saying they can't verify any of the information because the media is being banned.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. The media is being controlled? They're criticizing another country when they don't let nothing come out of Iraq. Bro, they got absolute control over every bit of information that comes out of Iraq.
Yeah.
That's why they only say the numbers of American soldiers that are killed. That's the rule. Why? They learned from Vietnam. When they kept showing Vietnam, they had over 500,000 deserters, man.
Yeah, that's true.
That's why they left Vietnam. People want to... They don't know. You know why they left? Because the people stopped fighting. You had mass people leaving the military structure, disobeying commands, frag incidents all over the place,
yeah,
where the soldiers come back and kill their commanders or try to get them. You know what I mean? That was going on at a super high rate. All the morale was gone. So they learned their lesson. This time we ain't going to give up that much information. We're going to make it look like a computer game. Ain't that what it looked like when they went and invaded Baghdad, when they was doing a shock and awe period? Looked like a video game.
Yeah, you're right. Maniac, can I ask you a question? You alluded to something when you were talking about Lavelle Nixon, and before, actually right before you were talking about Lavelle Nixon, you were talking about, you put into, you beautifully gave a description of the prison industrial complex. And what I love about your organization, and I don't know like the intricacies because I'm not, you know, working with it, but I know you do. I understand that you help parole. Number one, you help get inmates on parole, and then also you provide jobs. And
we do,
and
we do all that. We call that the parole package. It's something that my wife kind of developed just based on us working on Chip Fitzgerald's case. Chip Fitzgerald is the longest held Black Panther political prisoner. He's been in there 40 years. He's from Los Angeles, so two reasons we kind of jumped on his campaign. One was because he was the longest-held Black Panther, and no one knew who he was. So that was one factor. Like, man, we know all these other dudes. We hear their name every day in songs and websites. Where's Chip? He's in there longer than all of them. That was one thing. Two, he was from Los Angeles, which is where I came up, which is where I was trained by. We all Bunchy Carter. We all his troops. So I felt like it's my obligation as one of Bunchy Carter's troops to look out for one of my comrades that was from my area putting in work. So I felt obligated. I felt ashamed that I didn't know who he was and that I wasn't involved in his life. I felt ashamed of myself. So we got involved and just getting more familiar with the whole process because he was on, you know, about to face parole. We decided to develop a parole package that would help prisoners get out because we know the typical like line that the system comes with. They got all these different things to keep you in when they don't really have an obligation to help provide them. So far as I'm concerned, I don't really get it how you can I don't really see how you can tell someone, you know, this is your sentence. You can parole now as long as you're good, you know, so you have a pretty decent record. Then when it's, you go up for review, they have these other reasons you're not let out, and you're in jail anyway. So how do you make everything, like you got unemployment at a high rate right now, one of the worst ever in the history of the United States since the Depression, whatever these statistics are, and you're going to tell a person that's been in prison for 20 years that he can't get out because he ain't got no job when people out here that have job skills that ain't been in jail 20 years can't even get a job? I mean, it's like it's obvious they want to keep him in there. Then if you're politically active, it's a done deal. I mean, George Jackson went to jail for a $70 robbery and never got out.
Yeah.
Because he was political. He organized. He stood up. So I look at all this as just a system of breaking us. The whole system is designed to break us down. Because why would they fear Malcolm, Martin, Bunchy, Huey, George, Fred, Daruba Moore, political prisoner, Asada Shakur, she got $1 million bounty on her head. I mean, why would they fear these? I mean, is she really a threat to the United States of America? Come on, be real. The threat is not the physical threat or the military threat. It's the psychological threat. They don't want us to psychologically see or think that we can resist. And that's all it is. They don't even want us to even think that we can fight back. And that's what makes what they do worse than anything else. Because everywhere else, everyone knows if you're a slave or you're oppressed or whatever, they assume you're going to fight. And they're not going to say you can't fight. But us, we can't even fight. And then when we do resist, they tell us how to. Right? Oh, y'all can't do that. Y'all can only walk down the street, hold hands, sing Kumbaya, and hold up some signs. And you better be done at 7 o'clock when the permit is up, or we gonna beat y'all down with sticks and put y'all in jail. I mean, they really clown us real bad.
Yeah.
We really don't have any room to fight. So we really shouldn't care. Right? We shouldn't really care. It's like if somebody come and beat you up and take your money, you really don't have to ask him permission to fight back, or what's the legal way for me to, how should I get back to you, sir? That's what we do. That's what Malcolm, you know, didn't understand it. Going to the perpetrator of the crime, you know, the system. Malcolm said this system is not designed to, you know, produce freedom for our people. How did he make such a bold statement? Because Malcolm was a student of history. So one of the things we do with the prisoners is not only do the parole package, but we actually put them through a program called G's to G's, right? G's, the first G stands for gangster, and it's a small G. The second G stands for governor, and it's a capital G. So our goal is to take them through a seven-step program where they gradually transform themselves into real men, because that's what all of us were trying to do when we started gangbanging. We were trying to be what we thought a man was. We were trying to govern our hood and control it. We just didn't know how. And worse than that, we weren't in control of our own selves.
Right.
So before we can govern our environment, we must first govern ourselves. That's the basis of it. So the first step in G's is self-mastery. They learned about their history. They start learning about the development of gangs in L.A., which automatically ties them into the consciousness movement, to the Panthers. So just by teaching them the history of gangs, it's going to bring them to the Black Power movement.
Right.
It's going to introduce them to movies like Bastards of the Party, Crips and Bloods. Those kind of movies are the kind of things we'll let people see. If they're in prison, then we send them literature. We, you know, books, or we talk to them on the phone and engage them. And then they write letters. We have a letter writing campaign that's a part of one of the steps. It's called redemption, because we got seven steps, and they all get back to restoration, or restored back to who we really were. But one of the steps is redemption, because we have to redeem ourselves for the destruction and the harm we brought to the community, the misguidance. We guided other kids astray. We didn't just do wrong ourselves. We influenced others to do wrong. So how do we redeem ourselves? One of the things we do is we get these hardcore OGs to write letters that we read to the young people when we go to their classes or teach these different at-risk youth centers and stuff like that. And it's a dynamic thing, bruh. It's a mind-boggling thing when they read them letters. They're really heartfelt because they know this dude is talking to them. And we're going to be setting up interviews where we're going to get video letters. You know, we got to go through different new clearances and stuff, but it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then that's going to even be more powerful because the word and the visual, you know, when they see these cats and they see this is a real cat, this real, you know, a G, he's up in there, high level four, you know, which is the highest level in, you know, yards and, you know, when you really with some killers out there. And these, so they're respectable, they're reputable. They get the immediate respect of these youth because these youth are trying to be like them. They're trying to go where they already went. So who better to transform these youth than the ones who help guide them in the wrong direction? So that's one of the campaigns we're doing. Part of the Jesus, the Hood Council. One of the things that they have to do is when they get into the program and they work with BCF, they have to be involved with the council some kind of way because we have to organize these young men. That's what they don't want. The moment we begin to organize them, we'll change the community immediately. So we've done where different hoods have come together and worked in another hood to do some cleanup work. You know, that's what we're trying to work on. Where we, first, say we have 12 hoods at the table, 12 different gangs represent 12 different neighborhoods. Once a month, all of the other 11 are going to go work on one hood and build it up and clean it up or whatever, do some charity work or whatever. Then the next month, we pick another hood. That's the process we're in right now. We haven't done all of the hoods, but we're working on it. You know, it's all a work in progress because we don't have a lot of funding. You know, we're working on getting funding. That's why we decided to go the nonprofit route. BCF was not a nonprofit organization for many years. We were grassroots.
Yeah.
But so many people said they would help and wanted to, you know, man, you could get money. You guys need to get the nonprofit so you can give people confidence to give because if they just give it to you, they're not really sure. Versus if you had a vehicle in place that people can do the taxes. So we set it up about 4 years ago. We didn't feel it was wise to use the word Blood Crip Foundation for the nonprofit when we're dealing with funding and finance. So we one of the young men, I don't even remember the cat's name anymore because he was in our organization for a while and he's no longer around. But he came up to us one day when we had a meeting and said, man, building communities and families. Because we had about 10 acronyms, you know. Building collective finance, brothers connected forever, building collective. I mean, just we had all kind of clever ones, but none that I felt comfortable with registering as an official nonprofit. These are all like street little. When he came with that one, I said, I'm taking it. That's the one right there. Those three words identify what we are trying to do.
Building community and family.
To a T.
And on one end, you have the work you're doing with the with the inmates, the ex-cons, you're doing the work with getting folks, helping folks get paroled. You have the peacemakers, but on the other end, you're also preventing young brothers and young sisters from getting incarcerated with the other arm of BCF, which is the Youth Uprising. And I heard you're working on like a musical with the youth.
Right.
What's some of the stuff you do with youth and Youth Uprising?
Well, it's not an arm of BCF. It's another totally different organization, very powerful organization. I work for them, and my role is a violence prevention coordinator. I work with them. The team I work for is called the Peacemakers, and we're a department within the Youth Uprising Center. It's like the facility is awesome. It's in the middle of like one of the worst neighborhoods, so it's right in the hood, and it's here for the young people. And what I'm trying to do here is to take my expertise and my background dealing with youth at risk and gangs and try to infuse that into the peacemaking formula that already was in place when I came. And one of the things that they were already had as their program was the musical messaging project where we use music as a way to kind of develop the culture because that's what we're trying to get, a culture shift. So that's something I'm working on directly as my role here as the violence prevention coordinator. So we're working on, you know, we got like Too Short to Commit. He's the kind of lightweight volunteer up here because it's right in the neighborhood he grew up in. So I've met him a couple times just coming in, walking around, you know. So he's going to be on the project. I'm trying to get a couple other big names, but primarily it's going to be the youth that come here that are members of the organization. We have like four or five studios. We got a career. I mean, it's an awesome spot. But a lot of the youth do come here because of the free music production that we have. That's kind of the noise you've been hearing, you know, some of the kids coming out the studios with the music bumping and stuff and singing their little hooks and stuff. But it's, you know, it's a space in a very violent, it's one of the most violent cities in America, especially black on black. It's just nine out of every ten murders is a black man killing a young black man here. I mean, it's really bad. So this is the only spot in the East Oakland, which is the largest part of Oakland, that they really can go to and hang out and kick it. So we try to develop culture. We try to develop their consciousness. But some of them, they just here because this is a safe place for them.
Right.
They can talk here. You know, we have a living room that we built in the front that's like a big open space with couches and stuff, and the kids can just from the neighborhood can come in there and sit in there. They don't even have to be members. They can just come in and chop it up. When Lavelle Mixon killed those police, that weekend, that Monday, we brought all the kids in the neighborhood, all the kids that are members, and we had about 70 of them in the living room in the front, and we just said, what's up? What y'all think? Anytime a dramatic event like that goes down, we get everybody in the living room, the staff, the kids, and just, what's up? And, you know, it's real talk. You can say what you want to say. Get it off your chest. But it's a place that you can do that. And they don't have enough of that. So one of the things we're trying to do here is with the peacemaking team is we got the outreach team. They go out into the rawest neighborhoods, high incident areas at night all the way up to 1 a.m. Like, ain't nobody doing that kind of outreach. Nobody. Nobody's going out at night in the hood like East Oakland at up to 1 a.m. outreaching in the hot spots. And they're going to these spots where the youth is hanging out, drugs is being sold and, you know, guns and everything. And they're just trying to introduce themselves, chop it up, build relationships, and offer our services. We got all kinds of wraparound services that we provide, whether it's employment opportunities, education, people on parole, or trying to get off probation. We go see officers, and, you know, we got health and wellness, mental health practitioners here. We got a mentoring program for men and women. I mean, we got a lot of dynamic stuff here. So we just go try to let them know about that. And sometimes that changes people's lives. Sometimes learning about the opportunities that are there, the services, they may make better decisions. So that's part of what we're doing as well. And like I said, we're trying to take the model that we established in Long Beach with the hood councils, and we're working on setting that up here. And it hasn't started, but it's going forward because so many of the people that we're meeting, shot callers, you know, youth that have influence in the streets, they feeling it. And the funny thing is, some of them said, man, we've been waiting for this, you know. And I guarantee you do this kind of stuff anywhere and you get the right people to do it, the people there are going to say the same thing. Man, we've been waiting for this. Because some people are fighting and gangbanging, but really deep down inside, they wish it would stop.
Right.
So when somebody can come in with some light that has enough influence and respect to get people to listen, when they're really honest, they be like, you know what? That's what I'm talking about. So the way it's done is you got to get people from the neighborhoods to buy into the concept. And
right.
You got to give them some incentives. There's got to be incentives involved because it's hard to get people to unite when they're already beefing and then there's no real incentive. I mean, you can tell them about the prison and, you know, all that, but that ain't enough. That's just kind of get their consciousness raised. Incentive is like, we do this, this is what we get out of it. So
right.
We're working on teaching them how to incorporate. Part of our program, After Self-Mastery, involves employment and entrepreneurial training, where we teach young people how to be employable, right, and then ultimately how to establish their own businesses, because we want to shoot for independence. We want to shoot for self-determination. And entrepreneurship does have that quality in it. When you become an entrepreneur, you do have a lot more self-determination than you do when you work for somebody.
Right, building black businesses. We control the distribution of the products in our community. That's what it's about.
We spend $800 billion. I mean, just real quick, $800 billion a year. There's like two black people that are billionaires. Every year we can make 800 black billionaires if we kept our money inside. It's real simple.
Yeah.
95% of our money spent outside of our community. And we wonder why black businesses struggle.
Exactly.
You know, and then, yeah, black businesses, they do have criticisms. You know, they're not professional. They don't have the best facilities. But if you put $800 billion in there, guarantee you all that stuff going to elevate. Every business started off. You think the first McDonald's was as polished as they are now?
Yeah. All
right. Everybody grows. So we have to believe that if we pour our resources into these businesses, one, the ones who ain't up to par, they're going to fail, but somebody else going to step up
because
the money's coming. So, yeah, let the competition go down between us. So, yeah, if your services are poor, I step up. But instead what we do is we don't go to a black business because they talk to us crazy. But we go to these Koreans or these out here, these Arabs, and I'm not hating on them, but they're real rude and disrespectful, and we still go shop at their stores, though. I don't get it. We give everybody else a million chances, and we don't give ourselves any. When you go put money into the hands of another black person, that money's going to go filter into his family. It's going to help the education of his children. It's going to help the purchase of his property. All these elements that we need to upgrade our economical situation, it's a no-brainer. It's a no-brainer. So we have to change the economic perception of our people. That's going to fuel a lot of political stuff, a lot of political movements. Like, you know, the grassroots left wing, you know, the grassroots revolutionary movement is financially strapped, bruh. Ain't nobody pilling no revolutionaries off, nothing. They got money for video games for their kids. They got money for watching these damn Transformer movies and all that. They ain't got no money for the freedom movement, bruh. None. Can't have no movement without money. So we got to change our economic perception. And the more we start purchasing from our own, it'll create more black entrepreneurs because more of them will strive to build products and things because they see that we're spending our money with us.
Right.
Then you'll start seeing an elevation in support of the movement because more of the money's coming back in. Like, yeah. We got, what's that one group that has the economic thing going where they all, I forget the name of the leader of them got shot by the snipers in D.C. a couple years ago. Remember, one of the people that got killed by the D.C. sniper was the founder of some collective economic thing.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. But
right.
I'm just saying that's
a good thing. That's a good thing that not enough of our people are aware of. So I'm just saying when we get that going, the perception economically, then we can start seeing a lot of political change.
And that's a good place to end. We have about like 2 minutes left, and I want you to have the last word. If you could tell the listening audience where they can find, I know one of your websites is www.b-c-f.org, but if there's an email that you might want to give out where people can contact you before we wrap up, and before we wrap up, I just want to ask you if you wouldn't mind coming back on before the end of the summer so that we can continue to talk about, because you're doing so much stuff. There's a lot of things that we didn't get to, and I want to like talk about some of the growth that you're going to experience this summer. So I want to know if we can, if you wouldn't mind coming back on the show in about a month or so's time.
I have no problem, brother. It's an honor and a pleasure. You know, somebody wants me to say something, so I have an obligation to speak. One, I want to give a shout out to my family on the East Coast. Senghor Bey, the president of UNIA, ACL, Farouk Mohammed, the consulate general, Naji Mohammed, who's an activist that has a radio show, and he's organizing a lot of powerful stuff. They got the Black August celebration coming out there. Kim Bey and her husband, like family to us, and all the people that's trying to keep the spirit of the movement alive. It's an honor to speak and work with you as well, Solomon, and the youngsters up at your campus at U of M. I don't remember the names. I just remember the faces and the spirits that, you know, you've impacted them and you got them on the right path. So, you know, it's a real honor, brother, to work with you. And whatever I can do for you to speak or whatever, you know, it's no problem. In terms of other websites, the only thing I can say is buildingcf@yahoo.com. Again, that's building, the word, CF, all one thing, @yahoo.com. That's our official email. Our phone number is 562-413-5572. That's our contact number. And if you need help with gang intervention, we have programs. We got everything when it comes to youth at risk. So that's what we specialize in. But we also do other stuff too. So if you're out there and you're working with youth, or you want to work with youth, or you know people that do, and you want to turn them on to us, feel free.
Thank you so much. And he will be on with us again before the end of summer. And the feeling's mutual with my brother. As far as I'm concerned, we're family. You're my brother, and I look up to you. And you've really inspired by the work that you've done. Since the first time I met you, inspired me to continue to press on. And it's been a pleasure. And I look forward to continuing to build with you in the future.
Likewise.
Thank you. And so we'll be back on tomorrow at 11 a.m. We're going to have a special 4th of July presentation. So it's going to be tomorrow, July 3rd at 11 a.m. East Coast time. And so if you know the politics of the show, our 4th of July celebration is not going to be...
Right. 4th of July. That's what we call it out here, 4th of July.
Exactly.
And real quick, I just want to throw a plug out there. People that are interested in mentoring young men and know that young so-called black men need mentoring, there's a beautiful movie out called Equinox that I recommend people look up online, EQUINOX. Look it up. I think it's Aquabin Entertainment is the name of the company that put it out. But it's a great movie. You've seen it. I highly recommend it. I definitely think people need to get it if they really want to see something that's impactful for young men.
Thank you. And we'll see you later, and we're gonna end the show with Maniac rapping in his song called Hypocrisy. And probably the next time he comes in, and it's a very impressive song already, and it's not even mastered yet. So once he's polished it up, it's going to sound even better. But to me, it sounds outstanding, and I'm going to continue to play this on the show. And so this is Hussein Maniac Bey called Hypocrisy.
I love you, brother.
I love you too, brother.
No matter what, I ain't never giving up on my people. On the street scene, my team is legendary, cause we known to get cream by any means necessary. Running the streets and coming with heat, leaving everyone in your fleet stunning defeat. Folks screaming militant slogans a little bit louder, people still lack economic and political power. Every time we try to unite, shit it goes sour, cause leaders of the movement are just typical cowards. They wanna stop gang banging, what kind of shit is that? They need to start with the Republicans and Democrats. The government is full of crap, so get rid of that. Claim they for peace, what the fuck they doing in Iraq? This is the fact, so stop your drama. The game I spit will shock your mama. Same as the middle name of Barack Obama. Who's behind 911? It's not Osama. Yo, I mean it. It's coming from my heart. I got the torch, carrying on the legacy of my forefathers. All your fantasies, I'm spoiling and killing them quick. I'm like Malcolm on the toilet on some militant shit. So I never pledge allegiance to this damn nation. My people being treated like we live on plantations. So I'm building this revolution in the wilderness. You claim you didn't know skills like this still exist. I'm in control of every word like a ventriloquist. You must have lost all your nerve if you ain't feeling this. Listen, man, you need to change your business plan. Invest in Africa, it's the world's richest land. Give up on Americanism, Eric's vision. My people never would listen. I could never forgive them for the sins they committed against my kids and kin. Rape the women, lynch the men. I'ma get revenge against the system, cause it's played with racism. Every time I walk the streets, I face prison. Brain causes insane pain. Hussein came to spit enough common sense so we can make change. You called it the matrix, your lyrics don't make sense. The only reason you number one is you ain't shit. Face it, look in the mirror, you on some eight shit. I can't take it, you disrespected the ancients. The track must be mixed with Heron the way I laced it. Your flow is basic, people think mine came from spaceships. Everything contained in the brain is Hussein came from the chain of a slave ship and the pain of a slave whip. All a brother really wanted some enjoyment. Can't find a job, still don't qualify for unemployment. America can shove it, want me to love it. Bail out the rich, crying to the public about cuts in the budget. Arnold Schwarzenegger, you can go to hell. But $8 billion to help us go to jail, but you won't prevail.